The crime documentary Making a Murderer is captivating television audiences on both sides of the Atlantic. It's a 10-part series. It tells the story of Stephen Avery, who was wrongfully imprisoned for 18 years for sexual assault. And after his release, he was then accused and subsequently found guilty of another crime, this time murder, along with his nephew, who was also charged. And many think they were set up, Stephen Avery certainly, by law officials in Manitowoc County in Wisconsin, who feared they faced a huge financial penalty over the first case. And we're joined tonight by Dean Strang. You'll be familiar with him if you watch the series, as so many of you do. He was Avery's defence lawyer, and he's with us. Good evening, Dean.
Good evening.
Why did you agree to take part in this?
Well, I think that was an easy call, once asked. It was a high-profile, notorious case. Stephen Avery was easily the most despised man in Wisconsin at the time. There was enough money available for the defense to make it a sustainable loss for me and my co-counsel, Jerry Buting. So it, you know, it really was a pretty easy call for a criminal defense lawyer to say, yes, I'd like to represent you.
But you know you were going to be televised. You knew that your practically every move was going to be on camera. What do you make now of the story that's been told, now that you've seen it?
Seen the film?
Yes.
Well, I think it's a good film. I don't know the first thing about filmmaking, but I thought it was a good exploration of larger issues in the American criminal justice system through the prism of two small, compelling storylines, you know, two men's experience in two specific criminal trials.
There is a strong suggestion that Avery is being framed for the murder. How rare is such a thing in the justice system?
That's hard to know. It really is hard to know. My own hunch, based on, you know, my anecdotal experience, is that outright planting of evidence by the police or, you know, moving of evidence from one place to another to make it appear more incriminating in its effect is relatively rare. My sense also is that if you broaden the scope a bit, that police exaggeration under oath or the police falsification of details in reports or outright lying under oath is not all that unusual.
There is a scene in which Avery's nephew, Brendan Dassey, is being interrogated. He's a teenager with learning difficulties. He has no lawyer present. And by a process of suggestion and saying to him not to tell lies, they get him to confess. How did you feel watching that?
That was really wrenching viewing. It was when I saw those tapes, you know, before trial in Stephen Avery's case, and it was every bit as difficult 9 years later watching it in the film. And that's unfortunately not an uncommon experience for children who are pulled into a police investigation or into the adult criminal justice system, and indeed for many people with learning disabilities or difficulties who are confronted with well-trained and aggressive police interview.
In this series, are we being invited, Dean, to decide whether Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey are guilty or not guilty, or is it something else that's going on?
Well, different viewers have taken it, I think, at different levels, and there's certainly millions of people who've taken this as an invitation to armchair sleuthing or to serve as second-string jurors, if you will. It makes, I suppose, a good murder mystery. There's no question about that. I think millions of others have understood it at a greater level of generality as a film that asks really important questions about how we administer justice in the United States. And I'm at least in the second camp, I think, of viewing the real lasting value of this film as a provocation for us to consider not so much the guilt or innocence of these two men in trials that happened 9 years ago now, but to consider what's happening today down the street from us in a police station or in a courthouse, wherever we happen to live.
But are the makers of the series as open-minded as they'd like us to think? They've told the story much more from the point of view of Stephen Avery and his family rather than the prosecution. The prosecutor, Ken Kratz, you probably know, has accused the program makers of leaving out some of the most compelling pieces of the evidence they considered important.
Well, it's interesting. The perspective on this is interesting, right? Everybody, of course, has a point of view. And I think what's jarring for people, we're so inured to the narrative that the state, the government, the police, the prosecution agencies put forward, that when we hear something or see something that doesn't hew closely to that line, it looks jarringly different. You know, if it takes a neutral or even defense-oriented view at all. The fact of the matter is, you know, as someone who had a front-row seat through this entire trial, this film manages to cram in all of the most significant evidence and arguments that the state made. And indeed, it includes those pieces of evidence and those arguments that at the time the state was insisting were its most powerful evidence and arguments. And I think it even-handedly does the same for the defense. Now, there's less significant information and argument and evidence that's omitted on both the prosecution and the defense side, but that's unavoidable where you're devoting, you know, 10 hours in total to this story, and of that, only 3 or 4 or 5 hours to the actual trials of Mr. Avery and Mr. Dassey. And you know, the Avery trial alone ran 6 weeks. So, you know, editorial judgment is unavoidable, and I think the editorial judgments made here are perfectly defensible as reasonable and fair.
Dean, you will know that many people in Northern Ireland, after 30 years of violence here, are left in a position where they'll tell us as victims or as the families of victims that they still seek justice. And we're also familiar here with miscarriages of justice that have arisen over those years. What would your message to people be?
Continue to seek justice. There is something innate in every human being that seeks justice. Now, we define it differently. We perceive it differently. But it's that human trait that makes improvement in our criminal justice system possible. Slow, yes. Incremental, yes. Frustratingly, sort of uncertain or unsteady, yes, to all of that. But that desire for justice is the key, I think, to any improvement in the way the institutions of justice administer it.
Dean, you yourself have been compared to Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. How are you dealing with the exposure?
Well, that's not a comparison I've ever made or ever will make. I have a hard time just being Dean Strang most days. And, the newfound exposure has been bewildering at times. Just so unlikely in the extreme that my wife and I have had to adjust to it and are still trying to adjust to it. But what's coming from it that is really hopeful and valuable to me is the opportunity to speak about weaknesses or systemic failings that I've simply observed, and almost any lawyer would, in 3 decades of working in American courts. And so I really do welcome the opportunity to talk about some of those larger issues.
Dean Strang, thank you very much.